The most important thing, I think, comes down to leadership and culture. At the very senior level, at the CEO and board level, they need to care about these things and signal all the way down how important it is that everybody takes responsibility for keeping business systems and networks and data safe.
There's no security without cybersecurity. In the AI era, the cost of a data breach is getting more expensive each day and only climbing. It pays to be prepared or you risk absolute disaster. Luckily, we're joined today by Jen Easterly, globally recognized cybersecurity expert and the former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Jen, welcome to AI in Action.
Great to be here.
You spent the early part of your career in the White House. How did that impact your journey into becoming this global cybersecurity expert?
So I actually spent the majority of my career in the military. I was in the Army for over 20 years. And during that period of time, actually when I was a young major, I was the senior policy advisor to Condoleezza Rice, who was the national security advisor in the George W. Bush administration. So I got there in the summer of 2002, was there for 2 years, but right after 9/11, right? And it was an incredible time to be a young military officer and seeing how national security decisions were being made. And one of the things, I think the thing that really stayed with me most from that period of time is I was with Dr. Rice as she testified in the 9/11 commission hearing. So that was in before the summer of 2004, was there with her. And I remember very clearly the vice chairman of the 9/11 commission, which of course was stood up to investigate the attacks. And he said, on that September day, we were unprepared. We did not grasp the magnitude of a threat that had been growing for some considerable amount of time. It was a failure of policing, a failure of management, a failure of capability, but above all, a failure of imagination. And that really struck me like a lightning bolt. And that has been something that I've taken with me throughout my career, whether it's in national security broadly or cybersecurity or intelligence or counterterrorism. But the idea that we need to ensure that we do not suffer another failure of imagination. And David, I think it's really relevant right now in this incredible world we're living in with AI, because you know, AI has rightfully captured the world's imagination, but it's up to all of us as technologists and leaders and security folks and engineers to make sure that we can leverage the power of that imagination without, again, suffering a failure of imagination.
So something interesting you said, the imagination thing really struck me, because as an engineer, as an architect, I talk to my peers and we have this access to these incredibly powerful tools now. Agentic AI is genuinely crazy. And I say to them, like, we have these tools. All we have to do is be creative, be imaginative about how we build. And this is building, obviously, for enterprise. But it's such a, I feel like it's such a good analog for anticipating a threat, because they're going to be imaginative. The bad actor is going to be imaginative. They're going to think. So how do you actually practically put that in practice?
Let me take you back to something else that happened in my career after I left the White House that's always stuck with me in terms of how do leaders effectively innovate. So this was in 2007. I was in Baghdad, brand new Army Lieutenant Colonel deployed by the National Security Agency, so the world's largest and most powerful intelligence agency, to the middle of Iraq, Baghdad. And some will remember that in 2007, it was really the height of the insurgency, violence at an all-time high. And terrorists were using these crude materials to create homemade bombs. We called them improvised explosive devices, and they were having catastrophic impacts on troops on the ground and on Iraqi civilians. And so my team and I were asked to build this new high-tech platform. It was called Real-Time Regional Gateway, RTRG. It was super classified at the time. It's all been declassified, so I can talk about it now. But essentially, we were asked to take all of the data in theater that was being collected about these terrorist bomb-making networks. So think about data from cell phones, from satellites, from reporting, from troops on the ground. Take all of that data and integrate it and correlate it and enrich it so that we could illuminate those bomb-making networks, not in days and weeks when the information was useless, but in hours and minutes, so we could provide that capability to the troops on the ground so they could disrupt these networks. And we sat in this van. Remember, this is 2007, before any of this stuff, before people were really talking about certainly generative AI, certainly agentic AI. This was a team sitting in a makeshift van amid mortar fire and rocket fire and machine gun fire. We like to call it extreme coding. And trying to make the system work. And it was hour by hour, day by day, week by week. And it was failure after failure after failure. But to my earlier point, there was no failure of imagination. I mean, we had people who believed that we could get the system up and running. And there was a real spirit of, you know, what you'll appreciate it as an engineer, of experimentation and entrepreneurialism. And we were able to get the system up and running. It took about 6 grueling weeks, but we got it up and running, and it provided this capability to the troops on the ground that helped them take thousands of insurgents off the battlefield and save thousands and thousands of lives. And to me, that's where I fell in love with technology. And I just had this massive obsession with data. How do we effectively leverage data in a way where we can actually have a real impact on saving lives? And I think anybody now who's in this world, the most exciting time to be a technologist and to be in cybersecurity is asking the question, okay, how can we take advantage of these incredible capabilities? And leaders also need to make sure that we're taking advantage of these capabilities, but not implicating even greater risk to the business. And so I believe in the power of technology. I believe in the power of innovation. But look, as a security professional, we have to ensure we can implement these capabilities in a way where we can reduce the amount of harms that these very powerful things can implicate as well.
When you were talking about the, you were looking at data source, cell phone, all this other stuff, like when they were saying we should look into this data, like it's kind of imaginative. You're thinking about
100%.
Yeah, you have to think about, you have to think it's not just looking for where the bombs were placed or whatever. And forgive me, I'm not well-versed in military problems, but it's this thought that you have to be, you have all these options to pick from, and someone's going to come to you and say, we should look into this. And you're like, that doesn't sound particularly right, but you do it and it works.
Well, the key was bring the data, right? There's always been this issue about, like, do you want to just hunt for data or do you want to collect all the data and then run your analytics against it so that you can actually illuminate alerts and information that you need to actually get the mission done. And so I've always been about collect all the data and then make sure that you can run the right analytics. I did that when I was working at Morgan Stanley, and we built our Cyber Fusion Center. We built a whole cyber analytics team to take advantage of the data that then allowed us to illuminate these insights that then helped us protect the firm as well as the firm's clients. So, you know, when you think about the world of agentic AI, I mean, that's the exciting thing, right? We went from this traditional AI, which is really about machine learning, and in cyber, we've been using that for over a decade. Then you went to Gen AI, which is more assistive. And now we're in this world with agentic AI. So you think about our coders working in this van and now having the capabilities to actually write the code and to, you know, we could probably have accelerated it from 6 weeks to like an hour or something like that, right? And so you think about these incredible capabilities that are going to help the defense. Of course, they're going to help the attackers as well. And that's why we need to really stay ahead of all of these threats and make sure that we're implementing these capabilities in the right way.
With this new complexity, with this new power, these tools are, like you said, like I believe is the most powerful thing I've ever had my hands on as an engineer. What is the biggest threat right now?
So we do need to be concerned about, and we're already seeing it, right? These capabilities are going to turbocharge the attackers. And just to kind of step back a second, I know you're probably very familiar with the threat landscape that we talk about, but you know, you have nation state hackers, China and Russia, Iran, North Korea. You have these vicious cyber criminal gangs. I mean, to the tune of the ransomware economy is now about $10 trillion, right? If cybercrime was a nation, its gross domestic product would be the third in the world after the US and China. And that's before these actors are now being super empowered by things like agentic AI, which helps them create very tailored spear phishing emails, helps them create much stealthier malware. So, you know, it is empowering the defenders. It's going to empower the attackers. I have to say, and this is the reason why I am super optimistic about the time we're living in. I actually think if we get this right, and we can come back and define what getting it right means, but I think if we get this right, if we're able to implement these capabilities, these incredible capabilities, I actually think we can see the end of cybersecurity as we know it. And that's probably a provocative claim.
Yeah.
You know, you remember back in, I think, 2000, where Salesforce, Mark Benioff, was talking about the end of software. I actually think we can see the end of cybersecurity. And the reason I say that is because there's something about these agentic capabilities that can help us solve the fundamental problem of cybersecurity. And that is, it's actually not a cybersecurity problem. It's a software quality problem. And that's why one of the things that we did at CISA was really focus on the development of software that prioritize security. So, you know, as an engineer, you know, we've been building software for decades, but it was the priorities were on cool features, speed to market, and driving down cost, right? Competing on cost. Security was always a bolt-on, which is why you have the cybersecurity aftermarket. But when we were at CISA, we launched this whole effort around secure by design, meaning that companies designed tested, developed, and delivered products where security was a top priority. And of course, IBM was one of the signers of this pledge that said, we are going to focus on security as a key issue. And so the reason why I think AI is going to create a huge difference is the ability for agentic AI to do the code refactoring and the transformation at scale. It's a big idea, but I think, frankly, one where in the next couple of years, we will see all of the flaws and defects in legacy code be refactored and transformed into much safer and more secure code. And I think that will be the difference in terms of creating a more secure and resilient digital ecosystem.
It's also going to be like a cultural paradigm shift of the way that engineers are writing, because we write to make cool features, we write to do cool things. But if you start with the anticipation, like I'm going to have this agent help me secure my code as I'm writing it, or refactor it. And it is kind of different. You said initially people always just wrote for cool features. And with CISA, were you able to, like this pledge that you had, were you able to see it implemented?
Yeah. So we worked over the past 3 years, we worked with vendors. Again, we had over 300 technology vendors who committed to making material progress towards more secure software. We work with universities and academics because, you know, probably when you were coming up, right, it was all about how do you code, but not necessarily how do you code securely. So everybody was taught to code in C and C++, which frankly creates a lot of these memory safety issues. And that is, you know, inherently insecure. When you think about software vulnerabilities, I know I'm probably geeking out on your podcast,
I love it.
But
it's perfect.
70% of software vulnerabilities are these memory safety issues. And so now that you have memory safe language like Rust and other types of things, you can actually write in much more secure code. That's fantastic, right? So we work with universities that are like emphasizing the importance of, yes, you can trade engineers, but make sure that they are focused on security. We work with regulators and lawmakers. And I'm, you know, I worked at Morgan Stanley, so I've seen like a massively regulated industry. I'm not pro-regulation, but I do believe there needs to be guardrails in a way that you can prevent the worst harms from technology. Like if you have regulation, it needs to be harmonized and streamlined. So we worked with regulators and lawmakers to envision the idea of a software liability regime. If people are creating code and not thinking about security at all, that's a problem. But most importantly, like everybody has to realize we have a choice in terms of the security of the products that we develop, that we use. And so there's like a demand part there from secure by design on the vendor side, secure by demand on the customer side, you know, because we all have a choice. And yes, features are cool, but if I buy a product that has cool features and then I end up getting hacked and all my data gets stolen, or I have to pay a ransom to try and get my data back, you know, that's not the situation that you want to be in as a customer.
Yeah, recently we had that. There was a social media app that was released. I forgot the name of it. I don't want to say the name if I do remember it, but they released all of this stuff and they just left their database open, like just to be queried from anybody. And someone just queried it, pulled down all the attachments and said, here, we have everything now. And I think that's a problem because that almost, in my opinion, that application was almost definitely built using agentic AI as like a tool to help build it. And the developers didn't consider the security aspect.
Well, that's the issue, right? So when you talked about governance and, you know, it's like, oh, God, governance people, you know, it's like the engineers are like, oh my God, governance. But I think something you said is really important, right? the folks who are building the tools need to be right there, partnered with, teamed up with the folks that are helping to do the policy and the governance, right?
Absolutely.
It doesn't sound sexy, but if you're going to actually take advantage of the innovations of these very powerful and very amazing tools, you have to realize that you have to do it the right way, because at the end of the day, this is different from shadow IT, right? This is the idea of bringing on some of these AI capabilities. They're much faster, they're harder to detect, and they're really powerful. And so the engineers who are ensuring that these things are brought on and implemented and integrated in the way that they can be best for the business have to be teamed up with the people who are writing the policy and the governance and the guardrails to make sure that we do it in the right way.
So the IBM released the cost of a data breach.
So first of all, I love that report because, as I said, I'm a data nerd. And so we can like deep dive into the report as well. I think you're right. So I think it was the actual stat was something, it was smaller in terms of the organizations that had incidents because of AI. I think that was about sort of like 13% or something. But of that 13%, a vast majority of those incidents were caused by a lack of controls. So we can look at this in a good way, right? It's actually a small amount right now, which is expected because everybody's still figuring out how to implement these capabilities. So it's a small amount of breaches caused by these AI capabilities, but the vast majority of those breaches with lack of controls. So we can start getting ahead of this now by recognizing the incredible importance of good governance. And, you know, most businesses are now bringing this together. I think you all have Guardium and Watson X sort of bringing together the security and governance. Many other types of companies are bringing this together. But look, at the end of the day, we shouldn't treat this as some unicorn out there, right? AI software is a type of software. And so some of the governance that we've put in place before to accommodate new technologies, we should take a page out of that playbook. First and foremost, there has to be somebody who is assigned by name to be accountable for managing that AI risk. Like having, I don't want to say an owner, because I'm a big believer that the CEO or the leader of a company actually owns the risk, but you need somebody who is going to be named to manage it for you. Then you need the right principles and policies. You need to have a really good inventory of the tools that you do have. You need to be able to manage, and this is a big one, third-party risk. Just as you manage the cyber risk of your vendors, you need to be able to manage the AI risk of your vendors as more and more people integrate AI into their products. And then you need continuous evaluation. You need red teaming. And like overall, I'm a big believer that you have to have the culture that says, yes, we are going to be innovative. We are going to experiment. We're going to be entrepreneurial, but we're going to do it in the right way so that we can keep our customers and our clients safe. And I just have to go back to David, like it can't all be on the business as we implement these capabilities. We have to demand accountability from the folks who are developing these capabilities.
Yeah, and it really does. The one thing I keep on thinking about, you said that the CEO is going to own the security risks. How do you talk to a CEO and you tell them, listen, this will slow you down marginally. You won't be able to build as many features, as many use cases as you want because you're thinking about governance security first. But like, how do you get them to say, you know what, you're right, I'm on board. Let me really, really consider security while I'm telling my developers to build this stuff.
I mean, I have to say over the past few years, and some of this is because of the high profile breaches that have occurred, the ransomware attacks that have been really a scourge on businesses large and small. I think my experience, CEOs and boards got the memo.
They did.
They realized that, like, at the end of the day, cyber risk and now AI risk can be not just reputational, but existential. And so when you think about some of the things in the report, right, I think it was the average cost of a data breach in the U.S. is like $10 million. Right. So think about
that.
These kind of statistics matter to a company that's trying to manage its profit and loss. And so, again, failure of imagination to not think about how these threats can manifest in your network and why it's so important to have the right types of capabilities and controls to mitigate your risk from cyber attacks, but also your risk of an AI-motivated attack by an attacker, or just risks from implementing AI in your network without the proper controls around it.
So what would the core components be of an effective AI governance strategy?
Yeah, as I was mentioning earlier, it's like not that different from all the governance that we put in place around information technology, right? First of all, you need somebody who is designated as the accountable person. And I think the closer that that person is to the person who's in charge of AI innovation, you know, so you're not seen as Dr. Doom over there, you know, you're going to ruin this person's day as this person's trying to implement things. But it goes back to what are, you know, you lay out the principles and the policy. I think transparency is really key here because employees, like, they want to use these capabilities. Yep. They use them in their life and they see how amazing they are, how they can enhance your workflow, your ability to get stuff done. And they want to implement them. And that's where you start having that shadow AI problem, right? Because people want to try these things out as they're doing their work. And so you need to have a lot of transparency about what are the various use cases, what's the timeline for how we're going to implement these things, how we're going to think about putting change management in place, how you do logging for some of these new capabilities, how we're going to do continuous evaluation and red teaming. And so you can lay this out in a way that people understand because they've seen it in terms of governance. But also, I think leaders need to be really forward-leaning in terms of saying, okay, we understand there's a huge demand signal, and that's an opportunity to be able to use these tools. So, you know, what's the, like, ideas marketplace for creating use cases and for bringing these new tools on board? What's our internal innovation sandbox for trying these tools out? So people feel like they're part of the process and they're not feeling like they're being held back from using them. But that, look, some may not be implemented because it may implicate too much risk to the business, but they feel like they are part of being able to ideate on how these new tools can be leveraged to make the business more effective.
So are data breaches inevitable?
I think back now today on that time in 2007 where I felt like we were dealing with like massive floods, unprecedented amounts of data, and trying to figure out how to enrich all that data to make sense of it. But it's crazy because it was really just the beginning, right? So 2007, the same year we were in that van coding up that system, that was the same year that Steve Jobs introduced the world to the first iPhone. Right? Sparking a revolution in communication technology that's changed how we work and live. It was the same year that a small microblogging platform called Twitter began to spin off and scale globally, following in the footsteps of Facebook, which had just become available to everybody over the age of 13 with a valid email address. And so now today in 2025, almost 20 years later, we live in a planet of 8.3 billion people. 6.1 billion on cell phones, 6 billion on the internet, 5.7 billion on social media. And so, like, at the end of the day, we want to build systems. We want to believe we can prevent really bad things from happening. But in a world that is so data enriched, so digitized, so connected, so built on insecure, flawed technology, where the priorities were all around features and speed to market and not around security, it is increasingly difficult to prevent bad things from happening. And so, you know, I have always advised businesses that I work with to focus on one word, and that word is resilience, right? At the end of the day, you need to plan for the full range of threats. It goes back to our imagination piece. Imagine the best, but imagine the worst of what could happen. Plan for it, prepare for it, be able to practice responding to it, practice recovering from it. That's why some of those tabletop exercises are so important. To include, you know, when you talk about what you do from an AI governance perspective, those incident response drills are incredibly important as well. Think about something bad happening because you've given too many permissions to an agent on your network, right? You haven't done the basics about thinking about, you know, agents as features versus agents as actual identities, because that's what they are. So thinking about all the things that can potentially go wrong, and then thinking about what you can do to get ahead of a bad thing happening. And, you know, by the way, one of the things that I talk about when breaches happen, like, the most important thing is transparency and communications. And that's not often what comes to mind right away. You're like, oh, we've got to tell the general counsel, who's going to have to tell the regulators or whatever if you're a public company. But the most important thing, I think, when a breach happens is to be transparent about what you tell your clients and customers to maintain that trust.
Is it just for the not only just for your customers, but also for the broader business field you're in. Like to anyone who, like, this happened to me, this can happen to you, prepare yourself against it.
I think that's exactly right. Look, when you're in something like that, if you're, you know, there are certain rules that were put in place, I think, where, you know, if you're a public company, you have to inform regulators. That's not how we rolled at CISA, frankly. We were all about, if a bad thing happens, tell us, but it's not for public knowledge. It's so that we can take the information, how you were hacked, what was the tradecraft that you think was used. We can take that information and then in an anonymous way that protects the victim, because we're not in it to name or shame or stab the wounded, take that information and protect the rest of the sector. So if it happens to one bank, it could happen to other banks in the sector, or that same type of tradecraft or technique could happen to other entities in another sector. So that was the beauty of what we were trying to do at CISA, was anonymize the victim, but help people understand what the tradecraft, what the techniques were, so that we could protect other potential victims from being hacked.
Was it difficult to get these organizations to give you that information?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, because we had worked so hard to build these trusted relationships, I think we evolved in a really, really positive way in terms of having businesses share information with us. But I have to tell you, David, like my whole operating principle when I went in and took that job, I came from the private sector, right? I was 4.5 years up here in New York working for Morgan Stanley. And I had seen both from being in the government and from being in the private sector. And the whole operating principle when I went back to CISA was add value to the private sector, right? From a government perspective, you have a lot of knowledge and visibility into what's happening on government networks. The intelligence community has visibility in what the adversary is doing. The law enforcement community has visibility based on investigative powers. So taking that, putting that together so that you can actually help private sector victims or even private sector entities trying to better defend themselves, that's where I think the government needs to focus. Add value. And if you add value to the private sector, they will very much want to collaborate with you because they will see it as not a transaction, but rather a mutually beneficial partnership.
Agentic AI came out. It's an unbelievable tool. It's very powerful, but in the hands of bad actors, nation states, or even just, you know, anybody really can write an agent to do something. What is the scariest thing? Have you seen anything that was like, oh, I'm going to think about this when I go to bed tonight? And I'm like, this is terrifying now that we have agents, now that these people who are bad actors have these agents.
There are a lot of really scary things out there that can be done to turbocharge attackers, whether it's highly, highly tailored spear phishing emails that anybody will click on, even somebody who has been doing cyber for a really long time, or very stealthy malware that's very, very hard to detect and prevent. Certainly, there are capabilities that have to do with deep fakes and disinformation. If you just look at some of the big news over the past couple of weeks, some of the campaigns out of China that have to do with infiltrating our telecommunications networks for espionage. What I always worried about the most when I was at CISA, and this is something we discovered a couple years ago, but you can think about how these capabilities could really be turbocharged, was we had discovered Chinese hackers from the People's Liberation Army had burrowed deep into our most sensitive critical infrastructure. So think about water and power and telecommunications and transportation. But David, it wasn't to steal our data or to spy on us. It was actually to be able to launch disruptive attacks in the event of a crisis in Taiwan. So this is a world where a war in Asia could, you know, you could see water being unavailable, power systems going down, trains being derailed, comm systems severed, all to essentially incite panic here in the U.S. and deter our ability to marshal military might and citizen will. So now that was a campaign discovered before agentic AI was being used either by defenders or attackers. So you can see how this can really turbocharge some of the very real threats, because you could have agents looking for those holes in the technology. And frankly, a lot of them exist. That China's very sophisticated, but they weren't using very sophisticated techniques to break into our infrastructure. They were taking advantage, again, going back to my secure by design point, of insecure, flawed, defective routers, switches, and firewalls that, oh, by the way, businesses large and small across the country and the world depend upon.
Yeah.
So now think about agents simultaneously, autonomously going after all of these points of edge devices that can then get into our critical infrastructure. So to me, it's less about the spying and the stealing of data. That's obviously a scary thing, but it's more about the destructive and the disruptive power that can really affect the critical services we rely upon, how we get our kids to work, how we get water, how we get gas, you know, at the station, how we get our health care, how we get money from the bank. So it's really the impact of turbocharging attacks against our critical infrastructure that motivates me to ensure that we can actually use these capabilities both to enhance our defenders, but again, goes back to my point about if we get this right, if we can build secure agentic AI to solve the legacy code issue, to help us refactor and transform the decades and decades of rickety tech debt insecure code into much stronger code, that's how we increase the friction on our adversaries. And that's ultimately how we end cybersecurity as we know it. The one thing that I will also say, you know, I think there's been some really positive developments that have happened over the past 6 months. One is around this AI action plan. It's very pro-innovation. It's very pro-US competitive globally, but it does also focus on the seaborne threat, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, which is incredibly important. It focuses on the secure by design piece, and it focuses specifically on cybersecurity of critical infrastructure. So a recognition from the most senior levels that this, the security of AI systems, is incredibly important. The other thing has been the focus on being more effective from an offensive perspective, right? Where you are actually focused on holding our cyber adversaries at risk in a way that they are willing to hold us at risk. And so I think that some of the things that are being done from an agentic perspective will, again, give us the capability to inform that offense-defense flywheel that'll enable us to be able to, again, hold our adversaries at risk. So it's not just them coming at us with all of their capabilities.
It's like MAD. Like it's the...
Well, I think you have to have something that a little bit closer to that from a policy perspective. And I know that there's some discussions around that. But as these tools become incredibly powerful, they will be not just the most powerful tech, but they'll inform the most powerful weapons. And so there will have to be some sort of, I think, arms control discussion that happens between the most powerful countries that enable us to keep our population safe.
Would that include limiting access to these tools to like regular people? Like would that include?
The tools that get weaponized with things, I think you can imagine, again, what that might look like. Just think about the most powerful weapons of the last century were nuclear weapons, right? And nuclear weapons, of course, were built and safeguarded by governments who were incentivized not to use them. Most of these capabilities are now being built by the private sector. And that's why it's so important that the government work very closely with the private sector. That was part of what was behind the AI action plan, was having industry and government work together. Because as you think about integrating AI into some of these military capabilities, ultimately, I think we are going to come to a place where if there are very, very powerful AI-enriched military capabilities, we may need to put those same kind of restrictions that we have on nuclear weapons. And I think, you know, we're going to have to start making those types of policy decisions in the very near term.
So what advice do you have for enterprises to secure their attack surface?
It's the same stuff we've sort of been talking about throughout, but let me just break it down pretty simply. Like the most important thing, I think, comes down to leadership and culture, right? Leaders who recognize that cyber risk, technology risk, AI risk is not just a reputational issue, but frankly could be an existential issue for the business. And so at the very senior level, at the CEO and board level, they need to care about these things and signal all the way down how important it is that everybody takes responsibility for keeping business systems and networks and data safe. And from a culture perspective, that everybody needs to have the awareness and the training to understand what the risks are of integrating new capabilities like agentic AI, but just at the end of the day, what their actions could cause from risk to business, right? At the end of the day, whether it's things like not enabling multi-factor authentication, like not having, you know, strong, unique passwords, not keeping your devices updated, you know, oftentimes businesses that suffer cyber attacks and breaches, it's really the simple stuff. I think there's a whole thing in the IBM report about what are the causes of these various breaches. And the number one cause, I think, is phishing. So people who fall for phishing attacks. And with AI, phishing is going to become even more tailored. The only thing I would take issue with is I don't think that's a root cause. I think that's much more a proximate cause. The root cause is always, why was that technology built in such a way that it made it so easy to phish that employee? And so again, it goes back to not only does a business need to have the leadership and culture that mandates the right cybersecurity controls and procedures and governance policy, but also what are we demanding of the technology companies and vendors that we take advantage of to help enhance our business? Are we asking them, what are you doing to ensure that the products that I am using are built as secure as possible?
Jen, thank you so much for spending time with me on this podcast. And for everyone listening, thank you very much. There's going to be much more AI in action with the biggest names in tech right now coming. So please subscribe for more. Thank you so much.